think I got it.
Well, I think I got to, when you talk about snapshots in Buddhism, what do you mean by Buddhism? It's unfortunate that Buddhism has got lumped together to the other religions in the world. Religion is not, there's nothing in Buddhism that suggests anything about religion at all. Religion is a very, very Western concept. In fact, it started with the, possibly with the Romans and with the Christians and so on. They say, okay, this is what I think it should be. So normally you look at religion, it's got a lot of things in it. In the Western way, when you talk about religion, it's got the dogma is the center of religion. Then you got the icons, the symbols, and the many other things, the symbols and the rituals, and then all the things which comes with. In a, if you look, go to a Greek Orthodox church or whatever, they've got all these things, all these drawings and all this. They got the incense and so on. And later on, when they decide to get rid of the incense, they decide to get rid of the icons. They still have icons in the West. They put a cross there, and then after that they say, oh, the cross is not important. But they, instead of having a physical icon, they have got a mental icon somewhere in your face, and you think that is what I'm worshipping at. And of course, other than these icon symbols and rituals and dogma, you've got those people who follow them, right? You've got the proponents of it, there's a whole hierarchy of it, and so on. Now, when the Buddha started that teaching, he never talked about this sort of things. He never meant Buddhism as a religion. He never said that, oh, when I die, you should put make a nice, beautiful image of me and worship me, or have all the gongs and the symbols and all the incense, all the banners and all these things that do with religion. When he was alive, he preached a very simple thing. Very, very simple. The thing to do with how to improve your life, how to improve an average person's life. He talks about human beings as a human being, as a human being to human beings, and keeping away from all these supernatural things. Right? In fact, I don't think the Buddha really believed in anything supernatural at all. Right? He talks about day-to-day simple things, like how you move, how you eat, how you sleep, and all this. But however, when he passed away, people make a big deal out of it. They start to think, oh, well, he's a good teacher, perhaps we should do this and that, and they start to worship him. People hero worship people. And you find that when, even in this modern day world, when a simple woman has passed away, a good woman has passed away, and they did a lot of good things in her life, and what happens? They make her into a goddess. They can pray to her and all these things and expect miracles to happen. And when miracles happen, they say, okay, you remain the same. So possibly the same thing happened to the Buddha. And you've got to imagine, in this 20th century, we are so advanced in our thinking. We are so scientific and so on. And yet, there are a whole group of people who want to make a dead person the same. So during the Buddha's time, or 2400 years ago, things could have been a lot more easy for the Buddha to remain in the same. So you look at his life, what did he do? Very simple thing, he goes around, he found, actually I'm talking about historical Buddha, I'm not talking about a legendary Buddha, right? When you talk about a legendary Buddha, that comes a lot later, it's stories. But if you look at the history, going through the Buddhist scripture, you find that he is born in a fairly comfortable circumstances. Right? He's born in the warrior caste, and he's got a lot of things which you think, it's a sort of a, born an introvert. He likes to think inwards and say, okay, what? There are a lot of problems. What are my problems? And his main problems would be, why am I here? The usual thing. When you get frustration, why is all this frustration? When you get bitten by a snake, why should I be bitten by a snake and not my stupid brother? That sort of things, You start to have these sort of questions coming in. And when you have these sort of questions, it's not easy to answer. See, the most difficult question to answer is why. You ever thought of it? That's why. Then they give an answer. Why? They give an answer. Why? They give an answer. Eventually, ask a few more whys, you come to a wall. Nobody can answer you. And when nobody can answer you, you're stuck. And then you keep on saying why, and why. Either you fall into somebody's spell, they tell you, okay, this is what I think is why, you must believe it, therefore you believe it. And that's how religion started. Because wise people ask, why am I here? Then people start telling you, okay, your mother and father have sex and then they give birth to you. That's why you're here. No, not good enough. Why am I here again? You start to look at it. Then eventually you come to a wall. Nobody can tell you why. And possibly these are the questions which the Buddha encountered. Why? Why should I fall sick? And why should there be an old man there? And why does he grow old? Why is he still young? Or maybe when you see a corpse, why is that the dead person there? So these are the sort of things. If you look at the stories which people tell you about the Buddha, that's all about this. When you look at it, you ask why. Then you saw a holy man. Those holy men during his time, where they leave everything behind and they just go one way. And you saw that person being so relaxed about things. And they say, why? And he asked people, he asked his priest, they say, well, possibly because, you're fated to be like that. Don't ask why, you go to die. And a lot of things, and he did not get a satisfactory answer. And when you get, a lot of people, when they do not get satisfactory answer, they just get resigned to it and follow it and say, okay, I'm going to be like that, so I'm resigned to my fate, so I must follow whatever it is. But for him, no, he wants to get the answer. So he left his family. What they say was his father was a king. Actually, he was a ruler of a very small city-state, a small state. Possibly could be the size of possibly Parramatta or Wokham Hills. Not that big, grand thing you read in the books, where his father owns millions and millions of dollars and all these things. It's just a small city-state. They belong to warrior caste. They sort of run the place in a way, taking turns to be the ruler. And his father happened to be the ruler at the time. And of course he got to leave home, and then he went to the next country, which is not very far away, it's just across the river. And he decided to cut off his hair and try to follow the life of a holy man. But at the time nobody taught him how to be a holy man. Everybody tells him, you go to this camp there, they tell him, you should do this, you go to that camp, you should do that. And it's like a lot of people nowadays. You want to find the truth, you want to find God, you want to find all these things. Go and keep on finding. But when they want to find, they don't know what they are finding. They don't even know. So he's groping in the dark, in other words. And what happened was, he followed this particular person to say, okay, you meditate. And then he meditated and became very good at meditation. But still no answer. You find that people who meditate, sometimes they're still getting cranky, they still get upset. If you don't meditate in the right way. And then after that, somebody will tell him, you must follow certain rituals to do this. And one of them told him to starve himself. When you go into that ritual of going have food one day and have no food another day, have one serve of food and half a serve, quarter of a serve, until he goes out eating only seven grains a day. Imagine what happens to you if you eat seven grains a day. So if you happen to see some of the paintings of the Buddha, there's one which shows a person who is very, very thin, all the ribs here. And that's the worst time when he had. Keep on starving himself. Now, starving himself of what? Because according to the popular belief in this particular group of people, is that if you starve yourself, you cleanse yourself, and eventually you will be free of your problems. But I think he realized that he wasn't free of problem, because what happened was, in the story, when he went to go to the river to clean himself, he nearly got drowned because so weak. And after that, he decided that at least I know that I'm stupid. I was stupid, so he decided to eat some food and nurse himself back to health. And then he keep on looking. Now, There's a story there behind it. There's a moral here. When he was looking outside, he finds nothing. Everything is what people tell him. It's all people's knowledge. It's not his own. But one day he decided to say, I'm going to sit down there and I'm going to do something. And he didn't know what he's going to do. But possibly by coincidence, he looked inwards, looked into himself. Then he realized that all these problems which he had was all caused through the inside here. Not because of your body, but all your, in your mind. So from there, you know, he started to look more and more into his mind. And eventually his mind opened up. Then he got the answer. Maybe, to put in modern day language, his answer is, you shouldn't ask why. Nobody can answer you. Even the wisest person on earth could give you an absolute satisfactory answer on why. But you start to look at it and say, what happens? You start to think, okay, one thing happens after another, after another. And you see that all things are conditioned. Your thought now is conditioned by your thought before, by the thought before, by the thought before. So it keeps on going. And he knew that, he started to realize that life is a process. It's a biological process. It's also a psychological process. And it keeps on changing. You cannot say anything to stay still for even one moment. Your thoughts move. Your body changes. Everything else in this world changes. And it's because our human mind cannot come to terms with these changes. Therefore, you can do problem. But if change goes this way, you're going against the changes, well, there's this sort of pulling. And you get tension within yourself. And you get this tension, that's where you get what the world is suffering. So he realized after sitting down in the tree for a few days, that's what he comes to conclusion. Now, people ask you, what is the purpose of life? And if you ask me, I would answer that. I said, okay, you talk about purpose of life, but tell me what's life first. So, the Buddha has found life. He did not find the purpose of life. Because you find the purpose of life, you go into the superstitious thing. Why somebody is going to will you to do certain things. But if you find life, then you start to understand it. When you start to understand life, then it's a lot easier for you to come to terms with your own problem. If you have a problem with your exams, well, it's part of life, isn't it? At this stage of your life, you've got to attend uni, you've got to do assignments, do exams and all these things. But if you start to say, I'm not going to do it, then you get problems. You either fail, drop out, or find that your hopes are all shattered. So what we got to do is, we got to go in terms with it. If I'm at this stage, I got to go along with it. And that makes life a lot easier. Now, all these things are quite simple, what the Buddha found out. But unfortunately, as time goes by, people try to make it into a philosophy. People try to make it a study and so on. And when you start to make things more complex, it really becomes complex. And so much so that when he died, when at the time of when the Buddha passed away, things are still alright because he's there to correct people. He tells you, okay, or what's wrong with you is, you know, what's wrong with us all is our mind and our body. We don't get rid of them, but we try to do something about it. Train the mind up. So that teaching of the Buddha is on working on the mind. And when you work on the mind, then you find that you can come to terms with a lot of problems in your life, and your life becomes easier. And when you can solve all your problems in your life, that's when we reach a stage where we call the enlightenment. If you have read about Buddhist book and telling you about enlightenment and think that's a big deal, it's not. Enlightenment is very simple. What the Buddha told us is, get rid of your cravings and you get no more, you'll be on the stage of enlightenment. A lot of people say, I'm going to get enlightened today, tomorrow, so I'm getting rid of my craving. But it's not as simple as that. It's a very gradual process. You've got to start to see, okay, how much craving I get rid of. And it's a lifelong process for all of them, in a way. So when the Buddha was born as a human being, then his teachings are all for human beings. He did not involve supernatural beings in his teachings, although in some cases he did refer to supernatural beings like that, no, that's what we call the gods and the celestials and all these things. But when he used that, it's just that he's so skillful that he can make use of that to explain a lot of things. So, if there's any reference in the scriptures on these supernatural beings like the gods, you know, you always mention 33 or Brahma or Sakha and all this, they are just being used to refer to certain concepts and ideas. Because among his students are people who believe in this sort of things. So he make use of this to explain certain of his teachings, to make it easier or clearer. But for those people who do not believe in all these sort of things, he teaches a lot of different things. There is a particular group of people called the Kurus, in the where he in under his influence at the time. When he goes to the area where the Kurus live, he doesn't talk about these gods and supernatural thing about you know, what's going to happen in your past life, in the next life, and so on. What he talk about is to train your mind up. You find that he explains the process of life and how we can train ourselves mentally and so on. So those are the two most important part of the scripture is found when he was preaching in that area. But however, when he was preaching to Brahmins, you know, Brahmins, they are very philosophical, they are theological and so on. So he's got to make use of a lot of this concept from the Brahmins religion to explain things to him. So there's this reference to all these supernatural things, but however, they are used as tool rather than as a belief. Now when the Buddha passed away, he was already considered to be a great teacher in an area around about 200 miles radius, about 300 kilometers radius. So how big it is, you know. And if you read the story of the Buddha's last days, about 3 months, he traveled, imagine an 80-year-old man traveled with a village person as his attendant, walking. He could afford a chariot, but he doesn't want to sit on a thing drawn by animals, so he walked to a various community and start to teach, ask the community, are you sure of my teachings? And his teaching is not asking them to believe in anything, but to say, okay, this is what it is. Give them a path. What the Buddha called the Eightfold Path. Right? The path in training on our wisdom, the training on our mental area, mental side, and also on our ethics, our behavior. So that became sort of a guideline for Buddhists. And these sort of things are still in the Buddhist culture. Although, when Buddhism spread from country to country, they start to add in the local flavor. So now when you look at Buddhism as a religion, we are looking at things which happened possibly 300 or 400 years after the death of the Buddha, right, the demise of the Buddha. When the Buddha died, he was cremated like any of the ancient Indian teachers. And whatever is left, the ashes were divided into 8 parts. And the kings, whoever supported him, took the ashes back and made a little monument for it. And so that place eventually become places for people to cover pilgrimage. But to those people who understood the Buddha, they did not worship that place. Those people really understood the Buddha, his disciples and so on. They never really go there and pray to that thing and say, oh, give me luck, let me win a lottery next time and all these things. They didn't do that. To them, the teachings are very, very important. In fact, his last few words to his disciples is, let my teachings be your guide, not me, not my successors. And you've got to work hard, but strive on diligently. And after he died. So the Buddha did die.
Is the thing that we don't need any Buddha statue?
It's not that we don't need. You know why we need the Buddha statue? Because our mind is so poor that we keep on forgetting the teachings. So the statue is there to teach to, like, make us remember. Sometimes, you know, I always think like you. I say, I don't need the Buddha statue, so I never have one. And then one day I'm getting further and further removed because I need something to remind me. So it comes, I have a Buddha statue. Every day I pass by, yeah, he's teaching. So, but however, that Buddha statue
became something a very, very of great importance. So much so that the Buddha statue overshadows the Buddha's teaching. Ah, that's where the problem starts. Right? So as the thing, now even after 200 or 300 years after the death of the Buddha, or the passing away, if I got to put it in a very, very respectable way, the passing of the Buddha, you find that there was no image. All these early works, stone carvings and all this, they show a wheel, they show a body leaf, they show a footprint. It's only when we come into contact with the small little Greek kingdoms in near Afghanistan or near Pakistan now, they have this sort of thing. They start to build, make statues, right? make what the missionaries call idols. Right? So they make that too, because it's in the tradition to worship this sort of statues. Right? So possibly the worshipping of the Buddha could have started a bit earlier, worshipping of the relics. Right? That means you know that better. It's like there is Buddha's unburnt bones, so you could pray there and ask for certain favors. And there's no statues yet. Until the statues are built, then it becomes very, very, it spreads very quickly. Very, very quickly. Within less than 50 years, all the Buddhist community has statues. Because, why? Human beings are always clinging to certain things, and visual things are very important to them. So they had that, they built statues. And the most important breakthrough of Buddhism out of India is going to China. Otherwise, for quite a while, for nearly 300 or 400 years, it's only in the Indian subcontinent. So, about 2,000 years ago, there were already merchants on the Silk Road going to China. Right? And part of the Silk Road was under the Buddhist influence at the time. Right? So the merchants who were traveling there, I mean, they are now all Muslims now, but in those days they were Buddhists. So when they go, they got to brought the monks along. Right? And Buddhism at the time in India appeals to the merchant class. Because the sort of Hindus or the ancient Brahmins, they believe in staying in one place. That means they are more staying in the village and so on. They won't like to travel away. But when they start to adopt Buddhism, they can travel away and become merchants. So when they become merchants, they brought along the monks and so on. So slowly, they built their thing along the Silk Road. But legend goes that during the reign of one of the Han emperors, the emperor at night dreamt of a very big golden god. Right? And he asked the minister the next day, he says, "What's that I was dreaming of?" He described to the ministers. And the ministers told him that it was, a Buddha from the west. Now, you see, the thing is, that association of the Buddha and the gods have already started. It's not. It's only about 500 years or 400 years after the death of the Buddha. It's already being made into a god already. So the emperor was quite impressed, so sent some emissaries over to India. And at the time, Buddhism is already started to change. The teachings of Buddha, original teaching, is started to have a bit of change already. But they still have the old teachings. So, and also, the changes could be more in one area and less in other areas. There'll be a lot of people who are still holding the orthodox teachings, and some of them have got this modern or upgraded teachings, as we call them. So when they went there, lucky thing, they didn't go to the really modern one, and neither did they go to the really orthodox one. So they go to somewhere which is in the middle. So, and India is India, right? To the Chinese, imagine you're born 2,000 years ago and not educated in your geography, and got no computer to find out, no Google to find out all this information. So what you do is you go there and see, okay, there's a big golden image there, or you must be Buddhist. Right? So in fact, all of two monks invited them to go to China. So when they came to China, they brought along some of the scripture, which has got quite a lot of the original Buddhist teachings. They went there, they sort of, the king treated them very cordially, and a lot of the upper class Chinese became Buddhists. But they became Buddhists not because so much of the original teachings of Buddha, because at the time the Buddha's teaching, a lot of Buddha's teaching is being sort of, the stress is not on this world but on the next world, right? And at the time the Confucianists and the Taoists do not have any idea about the next world. Confucianists will say, okay, when you die you become a spirit, that's all, full stop. But the Buddha's teaching on karma, okay, you have one life, another life, another life, another life. So it's very, very interesting to the Chinese, the nobility. So they adopted the thing, and then that's where it becomes quite popular. And over the last many hundred years, they keep on sending monks over. Some they brought back the teachings which are closer to the Buddha's time. Some they brought back teachings which are already transformed. And so they build their own temples, they have their own schools and all this. And from there it spreads to Japan, it spreads to Korea, it spreads to Vietnam. And of course there's one branch which we call the Indian Buddhism, which is not influenced by the Chinese. They spread the other way. They spread down towards Indonesia and all these things. And if you look at it, Buddhism up to the early 20th century still influenced most life than any other religion. More life than any other religion. They've influenced the life of the Chinese, they've influenced the life of the Indian, the people in the Southeast Asia, the way they're thinking, the culture and so on. Right? Although a lot of countries no longer hold Buddhism to be their national religion or being prominently Buddhist, but you can see the culture is still based on that, the language, the customs, the buildings and so on. So you can, if you consider China and India to have half the world's population, that means half the world's people are being influenced by Buddhism in one way or other. Now when you talk about Buddhism as a religion, it has got the same thing, right? The Buddha did not preach a dogma, but eventually somewhere in the line some clever people put in these rules and regulations and so on, what you have got to believe, right? If you come from this modern Chinese tradition, there's a lot of dogmas in it, which the Buddha did not want to be. Because dogma is fixed, you can't change it. Whereas the Buddha says, his teachings is not fixed, it follows you. As you progress, the teachings grows. So it's not something which somebody can write a book of it and say, because those who write books possibly will not have the same mindset as the Buddha. They won't be enlightened. So for an unenlightened people, if you write rules on things, then they can go wrong. But instead of dogma, what the Buddhists hold on to will be what they call the Buddha Dharma. But the Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. The teachings are all found in the Buddhist scripture. The earliest Buddhist scripture was written about 200 or 300 years after the passing away of the Buddha. That's the earliest recorded scripture. It could be possibly that somebody have recorded it privately, but if you look at it, it could be possible that not too many of the followers of the Buddha are really good at writing. At the time, literacy was limited to, you know, not too many people. But so in the early stage, after the passing away of the Buddha, they had these councils or meetings, right, to sort of standardize the teachings, right, to keep all the teachings together, because the Buddha could have preached one thing in this community, preached another thing in another community. So one of the leaders, after the passing away of the Buddha, he tried to put all of them together in one cave, not a room. So they, over there, they discuss and they sort of discuss what the Buddha taught, and eventually they make into a sort of a oral tradition, which starts with the chanting. So the original teaching of Buddha was kept in memory through chanting. The monks chant on the full moon and new moon day. Why full moon? Why new moon? Have you ever thought about it? So for those of you who light candles and incense on new moon and full moon, why? Just do it because you got to do it.
It's very simple, right? The beginning is very simple. Now you got calendars, you got a computer to tell you what day it is, right? In those days, you don't have calendars.
when you live in the community, in a cave somewhere, you don't have calendars. So the best thing is to stick your head out of the cave and see, right? If the moon is round, that's the day when we... If the moon is round, right? So if the moon is a bit more, less round, okay, 2 days time we'll sit and chant. So on the full moon day, they chant. And then they count 15 days of the full moon. When the moon is not a crescent yet, you chant again. So it's the earliest form of calendar. You put a week, how do you know which day of the week if you don't have a calendar, right? But full moon and new moon, you don't need a calendar. Look. So that's how the new moon and full moon. So they remind themselves every 15 days of the teaching. So it kept on until about 200 or 300 years after his passing away. Then they start to record. Record in the language. In, everybody start to record in their own language. But now the best kept language is kept in Pali. That's one of the earliest records. The reason being that this in part of southern India, there's this people who speak this sort of language, and they kept the thing, and then they start to write things. And when a monk called Mahinda went to Sri Lanka to convert the king, he brought along all these things with him. And he brought this whole set of things, full set of the scripture. And Sri Lanka has been a Buddhist country ever since then, without any break. Whereas India, you know, you've got some waves of the Hindu thing, some waves of the Muslims coming and so on. And in China, there are the same thing too. You know, it's always the fight between the Taoists and the Buddhists. The Taoists want to chase the Buddhists away, and the Buddhists try to get the influence and so on. So there's a lot of ups and downs. So a lot of scripture is being destroyed in that respect. So you can say that the most complete collection of those scripture, which is closer to the Buddha's time, is still found in Sri Lanka. And the tradition of that kind of people, Sri Lankans and the Thais and all this, they've got a very, very good way of keeping the scripture. Right? Because they got a belief that if you employ you to write the scripture out on your birthday or you know, when they grow old, you know, they give you some merits. Right? Merits means marks for you to collect in your next life. Right? So a lot of them do that for that purpose. Right? Anyway. I'm in trouble, okay, you know, get some monks to write for me certain parts of the scripture, and then the thing is being preserved. So that's how the tradition goes. It's been kept quite intact. So in modern days, most of the scholars would consider the scripture kept in Sri Lanka as the most authentic one. So much so that at the end of the 19th century, a lot of academics, you know, some say that they are being sent by the Bible Society in London to come and check on the Buddhist scripture, but I'm not sure about that, right? Because at the time they were trying to convert the Sri Lankans. Sri Lanka, or Ceylon at the time, was a British colony, but the people are so stubborn that they refused to be converted. Right? They converted a lot of other people in Africa and all this, but the Sri Lankan cannot be moved. And so they want to find out why. That's what I heard, and the possibility is a rumor. So they send these scholars to come and read, to come and learn the Buddhist scripture in a different language. And these people eventually, they're so so fascinated by the Buddhist scripture that a few of them eventually become Buddhists. And they converted the wife also become a Buddhist, so they formed the Pali Tech Society. And that's the earliest when the Westerners systematically translated the Buddhist scripture. So we consider the Pali Tech Society translation as really the authority on translation. But unfortunately for most of us here, especially the younger ones, if you read the Pali, the scripture in the Pali text, you find that it's very, very difficult to not understand, but spaceless, because they are written in the same way as the Bible would be written in King James' time. So all the terms and all this, all the references, all the grammar and all this are so foreign to people. So as time goes by, you know, in modern days, we do have a lot of monks or scholars who keep on translating them. A lot of them come from Sri Lanka. In fact, Sri Lanka would be considered to be the headquarters of this modern English translation. There you got people like Bhikkhu Bodhi, we got people like Venerable Rahula, who is a Sri Lankan but very good English, people like Piyadasi, they're all able to translate the scripture into English, which most of us can understand, or most of us find comfortable with. So that's how it is, you know, from starting from a young person who is not so satisfied with his life, he went out in a quest for finding out life, he found what life is, he explained to people life, what life is, he had started a community, which they are called monks and nuns, right, in this time, and he has got a lot of people, followers, who are not monks and nuns. So he preached to these four levels of people, the monks, the nuns, the laymen, and the laywomen. Right? So, from these teachings, eventually, when he passed away, he is being kept in Pali, and very well kept in Pali, and that's why he's passed to us now. So what are the teachings? It's very simple. What I learned in Buddhism is, when I want to study Buddhism, I don't look elsewhere. Look into yourself. As one nun has said, this: we always look out there, but we learn nothing. We always find fault with people, we find fault with everything. But it says, turn your eyes inwards. But when you turn your eyes inwards, it's still dark. You can't see. It's a dark room. So, switch on the light. What light? The light of the Buddha. And you switch on there, you can see what's inside there. And what you see, what's inside, you switch on the light, you'll be surprised. It's not something good. It's all the gunk and the rubbish and everything. Teach us how to identify this rubbish which is in us. That's what the Buddha says, the defilement. Our greed, our hatred. When you want something, what happens? When you don't want something, what happens? All this life is being what we call the pulling and the pushing. Every day you have that. Every minute you have that. Then you've got to make a choice. So I'm thirsty now. I want to get my thirst. Right? So I want to drink this thing. Okay. I don't want, I want. And all these things contribute to stress in life. So, Buddha didn't stop at that. He said you've got a lot of problems, but how to solve the problems? Now, solving the problems is not dependent on him or whatever. Right? Nothing outside there can help you to solve the problem. This is dependent as well. So that's why the training of the Eightfold Path. Right? And the Eightfold Path of having right understanding, right thoughts, right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration. And the right livelihood, the right speech, and the right actions. And this is only 8 things. But all these 8 things is all what we do need to do in the Buddhist practice. And that thing is to pass on. And of course, as Buddhism goes from area to area, from time to time, over the time in history, there's a lot of changes. You could change them a little bit. Because the nature of the Buddha's teaching is such. When you adopt the Buddhist teaching, it does not mean that you've got to destroy your other people's teachings. As much as we can, most of us are influenced by our surroundings. So Buddhism also are influenced by the surroundings. They make a bit of changes here and there, a bit of addition here and there. But of course, sometimes the addition can be really too radical. Sometimes it changes the whole thing. So it doesn't seem to be, if you look at it superficially, it does not seem to be like what the Buddha taught. So that's what happens nowadays. As I said, you got the teachings. You also got the icons. From time to time, people make. Actually, not from time to time. All the time. When you think of Buddhism, what is the first thing you think of? Think of it, one way or another. Right? Or some people might think of Buddhism as a temple, but not so often. When you think about Buddhism. I've already made a lot, I've checked with a lot of people. First image that comes in is that Buddha image. But the Buddha image is not commissioned by the Buddha. Nobody knows how the Buddha looks like. So, of course, you got these icons. And on top of that, not only the Buddha's icon, but in some areas, they added on a lot of these other icons.
And so you've got the female one, which is very, very popular among the Chinese, right? Because that's a personification of a lot of this teaching of Buddha, like compassion, kindness, and all these things. So they've got to put something to represent it. Now imagine you're a person in the 5th century in China. If I tell you compassion, how do you understand compassion? That's why if I put a nice, beautiful woman who looks calm and peaceful, you know, with a bottle of water, with a little willow branch in the hand, right, and tell you, oh, that one is compassion. When you're in suffering, the water will help you to ease your trouble. People will believe it. So that sort of thing happens. Right? I mean, that's the evolution of religion. Right? If they get them to that belief system. Once you start to believe, anything goes. That's what I told you in the beginning. Not only the peasants of the 5th century AD in China, but in the 20th century in Sydney, we still get things like that happening. Right? If I die, you think that I'm a great person, what happens? You find out where is he buried. Right? So I go there, come on, Jim, help me to pass exams. So by fluke, you pass exams. Jim helped me to pass exams. You didn't consider all the lecturers teaching you. Right? You didn't consider that you put your effort in. Okay, just because I played the gym, therefore gym helped me pass exam.
You got 5 persons doing that, then you can see that. The chief monk, okay, gym did that. Or chief priest, right? And then eventually I become a saint. You build a nice temple on my grave. And somebody will come and make money out of me. Come sell you some incense, sell you some tea marks with Jim's color or tea towels with Jim's face there. So that's what it is. Religion becomes business. So in Buddhism, that became business as well. It's unfortunate. So that is where, when Kerry asked me, I said, okay, the misrepresentation of Buddhism. When Buddhism becomes a religion, it's got all the trappings of a religion. You get a leader there who tells you what exactly to believe. And I kind of, in fact, the Buddhism I grew up with has got nothing of this sort. But now, increasingly, I do find a lot of Buddhist teachers, some monks, they start to tell people what to do. In the past, our teachings, the monks would teach you, they say, if you do this, this happens, if you do this, this happens. Now they say, don't do this, don't do that. So that religious thing is getting stronger and stronger. And that's what one of the things, if you really want to be a good follower of the Buddha, just be aware of that. Watch it. He or she might have a lot of good things to teach you, but they should not dictate what it is. I mean, I've got a case where somebody from Taiwan came and told me, he says, there's once a monk that gave a sermon on vegetarianism. It's good to be vegetarian. Of course it's good to be vegetarian. But then what he did was, after 2 or 3 weeks, after he gave the talk, he drives his car to somebody's house and sit down there all day and watch what they're eating. So that's not the case. Right? That's not the way Buddhists should be. Other religions do that. Right? Yeah, nobody should be the policeman of God. So this is the whole thing. The other thing is all these symbols. Buddhism has got a lot of symbols. Now, can you imagine any other Buddhist symbols? Lotus flower is one of them. The wheels. The universal one, right? And in Asia, the swastika. Right? So the swastika is always on the chest of the Buddha image. Right? And then you got other things. Right? So all the symbols are reminders. But they become sacred symbols. So people will consider that, no, if I put a lotus symbol in my, you know, become lotus flower, I put lotus flower in my house, I chase away a lot of bad luck. A lot of ghosts won't come in. So these are the sort of things we change. It's symbolic. Lotus flower is symbolic, very, very symbolic. It's an ancient India symbol. Because lotus grows in mud and no mud is thicker. Right? So they're talking about how we are. Right? We should wear lotus flower. We live in mud, but don't let the mud stick on it. And what is the mud? Your greed, your hatred. There are other, of course, other symbols and all these things depending on the kind of people, the sort of the kind of Buddhism some people follow, right? And of course we have rituals. Rituals are common in all religions. the Buddha did not talk about rituals. Actually, if you look at one of the most important of the Buddhist scripture, which is called the Brahma Jala Sutta in the Pali version, not the Chinese version, but the Pali version, it listed the first 30 or 40 things, listed the things which the Buddha never does, never did. And one of them is rituals. You never do fortune telling, you never do prayers for other people, you never chant for other people, and so on. And that is the whole thing. But as it comes by, when people get too lazy to practice, to really train the mind. Now, train the mind is not easy. Let's sit down there, okay, I get angry, I get all these things. So, if people are too lazy to do that, then what do? They go into rituals. It's easier to kneel up and down. Huh? I find that there's a Chinese ritual called it the 88 Buddhas, we call it. That's the confessionals. Right? Of course, we read the thing, and then we got to bow, kneel down, and just put our head on the floor 88 times, and get up and go down again. I find that easier to do than to sit down to meditate for 1 hour. So people want a shortcut. And there are people who tell them, okay, you do that, you'll be alright. So, of course, people take the shortcut and they do that. But of course, nothing is alright for them because they still get angry, they still get upset, they still get disappointed, they still get jealous. So, again, we place great importance on rituals.
All these practices can it be like a practice for us to more faith or train ourselves?
Yeah, it's good for concentration. Yeah. If you know how to do it. Right? If you go down there, now, in the teaching, in the sort of the mindfulness teaching, the Buddha taught us how to be aware of the body movements as well, what we are doing at any moment. Right? So if you're doing the next time you do the 88 Buddhas, if you know I'm kneeling down, you kneel, as you kneel down, the mind follows your kneeling. If you get up, the mind follows your movements, right? And then that is a very, very good training for your practice on mindfulness. So you know this, if you look at the Pali scripture, about one quarter of them is on training of the mind, how to be mindful. So in fact, you look at it, even the icons, the symbols and all these things are supposed to make you more mindful, like reminding you of things or making you mindful. The rituals especially, like when the ritual of chanting, the original ritual of chanting is the monks sitting down, full moon and new moon day, and they chant the teachings of the Buddha. And they chant the teachings for what? Not to let them go to heaven. They chant the things so that they can remember the teachings. So after a couple of hundred years, they start to write down. That's why we benefit from it. If the monks don't chant in the beginning, everything will be lost. So the chanting is very important. And but unfortunately, we tend to take the chanting as chanting. And eventually we believe that chanting will take away a lot of your bad luck. And we forgot what is in there. So if you look at it, one of the popular chants in Pali, when people want to move into a new house or getting good fortune and all this, is called the Mangala Sutta. Right? Mangala means the great blessing. In the Mangala Sutta, it's a teaching to tell you how to get this blessing. Right? Not through your prayers, but how to do it, how to get it. Is living in a nice place or being respectful, you know, honor your parents and all these things. Right? That are the greatest blessings. But most people do not understand the language and they do not want to understand the language. What happens is, I move to the house, call a monk. Right? I mean, do a chanting and feed the monk some curry and rice and that's it. So, it becomes a popular tradition. In fact, that's what we call corruption. But if corruption are not so bad, it's okay. I mean, we all have our weakness. Right? We can't, as you say, you know, pot can't call kettle black. Right? So we do have our own weakness, but when it gets too ridiculous, and sometimes you find that, I just went back to Malaysia recently, and I find that a lot of those Buddhists on the practice are so ridiculous. Asking to give money to this person, give money to that person. It becomes a business. Right? So it's about time that something should be done to it. All right, then we got all the rituals, and then our Buddhist rituals are actually more what do you call it, colorful than other Buddhist rituals. If you look at Tibetan ritual, they are really full of rituals. Right? But the thing is, it's because they already added that Tibetan flavor to it. It's not Buddhism anymore. So you can say, roughly, that what the Buddha taught us, the teachings of the Buddha or the Buddha Dharma, is actually like a cake. Right? You make a beautiful, simple butter cake, which is very tasty, which is very good. Then as you go round and round, people say, yeah, it's too common, too plain for me, so add a bit of icing, add a bit of icing, add a bit of icing, yeah. Eventually they add the icing, and they log into a house, into something. Then the icing eventually, to some, became the icing of Mickey Mouse. So you see, Buddhism, that's Mickey Mouse. So, we've got to understand, if you want to understand popular Buddhism, that there's something nice inside there. Only thing what you see is just the extra, the embellishment and the icing on the cake. So a lot of people come into Buddhism, they get the icing and taste, it's just icing, nothing much about it. So they get the misunderstanding of it. But some, if they're clever enough, they go right inside there and they get the icing. So we find that, in other words, when we look at Buddhism as a religion, there's too much icing, right? A lot of icing there. But if you poke deep enough, there is this cake inside there. Right? Only thing that for most people, they don't want to poke too deeply. Right? The icing tastes sweeter. But they don't know that the icing sometimes can cause harm to them. So when you look at these sort of things, where do we go? Now, we can always say that we can always try to look at Buddhism from the most fundamental level. Right? Look into the basics. And if we have the icing, then we know that we are having the icing. It's not that we should remove the icing. Right? Then you cut the cake, have the cake, and know that this is icing I'm eating, this is the cake I'm eating. So when we go and perform rituals, there are so many rituals you can do if you belong to Chinese Buddhists. Even the Theravadan Buddhists, you know, who are the Buddhists of Sri Lanka and Thailand and all this, they are supposed to be quite orthodox and follow the teaching of the Buddha. They still have a bit of rituals here and there. So when we are doing rituals, know that we are doing rituals. But try not to get into that belief, the popular belief.
All those rituals that initially they do it for our good. So that was why there was this ritual. But along the way people tend to forget the true meaning of it. Why do we do that? And that's why it becomes just a tradition.
Yeah, that's right. Now you go a lot of times in Buddhist families, right? What happens was, it just happened recently to me too. A lot of these people who perform the rituals tend to think of these people who hire them to perform the rituals as stupid people. Right? You go there, I tell you to kneel, you kneel down. Now, if you go to Chinese rituals, you say no. Right? You kneel down, you get up, you kneel down, you get up, put incense there. You don't know what they are doing. Right? When they go, they keep on chanting very quickly, you don't know what they are chanting. Right? So that's not the thing. Now, it's not that we shouldn't do the rituals. If my father were to die or mother were to die, can I perform rituals or not? Yes, why not? Because they believe in it. Right? So when they're doing the rituals, know what these people are reading. So that's where we make ourselves more knowledgeable. But knowledgeable is one thing. To be wise is another thing. Wisdom is another thing in Buddhism. Right? So the wisdom is to be able to adopt a personal practice. Right? Where we can improve ourselves. And this is one thing which a lot of traditional Buddhists do not do. You're starting to see a bit of changes nowadays. Right? You guys know would attend meditation and all this. Now, what is meditation for? Right? It's for you to change your own personal thinking and personal habits, right? Or try to make your experience a lot better. Right? When you look, when I started, I say, okay, this life, what is life? Two processes: the bodily process and the mental process. Right? So you go there. Now that's what we call karma. Your mental, bodily, and mental process. You know, keep going one station to another, one station to another. Now, in the practice of Buddhism, we're trying. If you go from one station to another, we keep on finding problems. Right? Life is not easy. When you do things, you eat something, it's tasty. What happens? You're not happy. You're happy for the moment, but after that, I want some more of it. Or can it be tastier still? Right? And when you get that. You get 50 marks, you say I want 60. You get 60, you want 70. Right? And so on and so forth. After 100, you say I'm still not happy with it. So these are the sort of things. Right? So the Buddha teaches how to come to terms with it. See where all these things come from. Why do you want to grab? Why do you want to push away? Right? So it's a training, right? To reduce our grabbing, to reduce this pushing away. Right? When you sit down there, the chair is not comfortable. You don't get upset straight away. You don't get really angry. You know the chair is not comfortable. But when you know the chair is not comfortable, getting angry does not help. Taking the chair and smash the chair does not help. Right? Look for another chair and say, can I change the chair or not? That helps. Right? So the Buddhists are like that. This basically the principle of Buddhism. Right? It's not for you to make yourself mentally agitated. Right? You know things are no good. If I cut my hand, I get angry. Get angry at people, get angry at myself, it's useless. The best thing is, I cut my hand, what can I do? Get a plaster, see a doctor. Yeah. So that's the Buddha's teaching. You get a problem, being upset with a problem, doing nothing about a problem, doesn't solve the problem. Find a way to solve your problem. And the way is being taught by the Buddha. The Buddha say how you get angry, how you get upset, how you get worries and all the things. Not why. Maybe you ask why once or twice, but don't get too far from it. Okay? So you find that in our... there are some traditions which are some rituals which follow the tradition from the Buddhist time. Right? Especially in the tradition of the Thais, the Sri Lankans and things. Right? You've got these festivals and... normally there are certain times when... we offer robes to the monks. Right? This robe offering usually happens in July, I think. July, yeah, somewhere around July. It's a big thing in Sri Lanka now. This robe offering is actually reminding us of the time of the Buddha. Because at the time of Buddha, the Buddhas do not have money. Right? Buddha do not allow his monks and nuns to touch money. Right? Because money makes them, will bring up their greed. So, in fact, they own nothing except a bowl and three ropes. So the ropes will get worn away. So during, every year during, after the rains, after the monsoon, they have this celebration and they give ropes to the Buddha. So that becomes a tradition. So in countries like Sri Lanka and Thailand and Cambodia and all this, they do have this rope offering to the monks. Right? So that's one of the things which is carried on. And one of the things when you offer ropes to the monks, it's not that just the monks receiving the benefit. We are also receiving the benefit. Because one of the teachings of the Buddha is to be generous. Right? So that generous teaching, giving things to people. And you find that possibly, I'm not going to, without any reservation, I would say that on the average, the most generous people are found in Buddhist countries. When you travel, you go to a village in a Buddhist country or a country which is under influence of the Buddhists, you find that even though these people have got very little or nothing, when you go through the village, they might invite you to get a house, right? And have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, right? And if they can afford it, they fry something for you, a piece of sweet potato or something, right? So that is the sort of thing. It may not be an expensive gift, but that is the practice of generosity. So in Buddhism, that generosity is very, very important. For that, they might not know you at all. You're just somebody who comes and goes. But the extended generosity to him. So this is the thing, when we start to give, when we do the ritual of giving ropes to the pond, that is what we do, we are giving ourselves, offering our generosity. But the gift is nothing, it's just a rope. But to the monks, the rope is something which they can use, and to us, it's something which we can allow us to give something away. Now the giving away, don't look at it as something unimportant. Because every time you give away willingly, what happens? You're giving a little bit of your greed away. And Buddha says, this greed and hatred are your problems. And then you give away your greed and give away with a good heart, then you're not giving with hatred. You're dealing with hatred. So these are the simple things which we do every day to reduce our suffering. Then of course there are days in certain traditions to commemorate the Buddha's first teaching. Now the Buddha's first teaching is when, after sitting down, remember I told you after sitting down the tree, he got so far enlightened, he becomes a Buddha. Now, and then his mind cleared up, he found the way, he found life. And when he found life, he goes around teaching people life. And the teaching was on the five people who used to be with him in training. And they were doing very austere training. They starved themselves, they burned themselves and all these things. They tortured themselves, but they still didn't find the answer. So when the Buddha started to eat, and they say, you have given up your practice. So they left him. So after his enlightenment, he thought about them, so he went to see them. At first, they refused to talk to him. But after seeing him, he said, how come this guy has got such a calm sort of feature? So they started to listen to him, and then he gave their first teaching. The first teaching is the Eightfold Path. Nothing more than Eightfold Path. What you call it, right understanding, right thought, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right livelihood, right action, and right speech. Right? These are only eight things which the Buddha asks us to do. But if you look at it, most of the time, if we are not into the Dharma, you find that most of the time we have got the wrong understanding, wrong thoughts, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and then wrong concentration, wrong speech, wrong livelihood, and wrong action. And you got all the eight wrongs, that's why we are in this soup. So, when you become a Buddhist, that's what we should be doing. Unfortunately, that thing, when you become a Buddhist, then pray to the Buddha. You only pray to the Buddha after you are very, very confident with the teachings of the Buddha. So you find that in Buddhism, faith is not foremost in our teachings. Faith usually comes last. Now the way we should approach Buddhism is, in modern day world, is to develop some understanding first. Right? Not complete understanding, but some understanding. Right? These understandings come from what we read and what we hear. There are only two things you can get this thing. You can't come out of smelling. Right? Not kind of tasting. Right? You kiss a monk, you get his sweat. Right? So you read and what you hear. Okay? Now, assuming that you are an intelligent person, which you are, otherwise you won't be here, right? You should be able to reflect. Okay? What you read and hear goes in here. Goes in here and say, okay, these things make sense. When it makes sense, then the next step is to have the resolution. Say, okay, I'm going to try it. Now, any of you from the Pali tradition, the southern tradition? Okay, you know this word or not? Ehipasiko, right? Is it the Dhammanupassana? Ehipasiko, Panaiko. So this Ehipasiko is come and experience, come and try. It didn't say you must. So this Ehipasiko, when you have resolution, then you start to say Ehipasiko, I'm going to try. I'm going to do it.
So when you read and hear, if you read and hear the right thing, right? Again, this is the next level. So if you read and hear what the Buddha teach actually taught us, right? It's on the mind training. It starts with your mind. Nothing outside there. It's something which is with you all the time. So do something to it. You've got the material, you've got the ability to. So you go to your mind. So you do this when you have resolution and you have this training. The training is very simple. Going around, just be aware of the things, mindfulness and all those things. So it's true, this training can be meditation, can be prayers, but it must be a combination of all of them. So when you have done that, then it's quite certain you're going to get some results. Now we have tried this many times. I've tried it in the Buddhist library. You go to start knowing nothing. Usually in the Buddhist library, our catchment area is quite wide and people know nothing about Buddhism. So they came in, help talk to them about training the mind and all this, mindfulness. And the first day, when we do our meditation, and then we sit down and meditate, you can see, after 2 minutes, people start to get restless. Then the next week, we come back again, do the same thing again, explain to them what it is, what the fault was, where you have gone wrong and all this. 15 minutes, most of them can sit. And then the third week, they do for 20 minutes. Then the fourth week, 25 minutes, and you say, oh, what about some more? So these are the sort of things. Now, you got to get to the right schedule, right way of doing things. Then this training, you get results. When you start to get results, you find that possibly, I'm a bit better than what I was before. I don't get so agitated anymore. Or when I get agitated, I know that I'm angry. So you get the results. And then when you get the results, you get the confidence, right? This confidence is, there are two pieces of confidence, two of this confidence. One in the self, those people who practice it, you get the result, you get the confidence, I can do it, right? And the other one is confidence in the teachings, whatever you read and hear and whatever you do. And when you get this confidence, then only you develop this thing called faith. This is a better way of training. Rather than going the other way, which is common in all religions, among some sections of Buddhism, the same thing. You start with faith. It's not that it's wrong, but it's more tricky this way. This faith is blind faith. You grow up in a Buddhist family. My father, my mother, all my grandparents, they're all Buddhists. So you must become Buddhist. Then you start to do the having a resolution. Then you get the practice. It's often when you do things blindly, the resolution will be blind and the result will be blind. So somebody tell you, okay, pray. Then pray to the thing. I didn't do my assignment, I can pray to the Buddha. So I pray to Buddha, then I didn't do anything. I prayed to Buddha. It didn't help. So the Buddha is not working. So faith is gone. So this is a very important thing you look at. This blind faith can be easily shaken. Whereas this one is through your own effort, your own resolution, and therefore you get it. So a lot of Buddhists, traditional Buddhist families do this, and recommend this is the better way. Try, do it, and then when you get it now. Halfway through your practice, if you don't get the results, then go back and read and hear. Find out more. Right? Maybe you might have not done the things well enough and so on. Okay, so now, what's the time? Is there more time? Well, Kerry asked me to talk about misconceptions of Buddhism. There are many of them. Too many that I can't list too many. One of my friends, he thought to be a good Buddhist is to go to a certain temple in China and just bang the bell. Bang the bell 5 times, he come back, I'm a very good Buddhist. Some believe that
you pay a lot of money, donate a lot of money, to do this and that, to build temples especially, big temples, is something very good. Of course it's good because you train your generosity. But that generosity is not very complete because you are trading. Just believe that I give you $5,000, I want $10,000 of credits back. The credit goes to my next life. Now this is the whole thing.
From all the Buddhist traditions you find that you cover this merit. Merit, I think in Thai is called Bun Merit. And in Chinese is this word. That thing can be bought. The thing that can be bought. So, it's not there. The Buddha didn't teach that. The merit you get through all your work is not in the next life, it's now. When you do something really good, what merit do you get? You feel good about it. You're more relaxed, you're more calm. That is your merit. So, in other words, when you do a lot of bigger things, then you get more merits. It's true, merits is the word they use, but the concept of merits. So much so that when people die, we have a big feast, invite monks and nuns to do a lot of chanting, and then hope that they get a merit. Well, if the Buddha is alive, he'll tell you you are wasting your time. Better thing is to let them do during their lifetime. Yes? The merit is what you benefit from, not the next life. Now, when you do your meditation, you clear your mind, the thing you deal with all your so-called defilements, your greed and hatred. The state of mind slowly getting calm, and that is the best merit. Money cannot buy. So, a lot of people believe that Buddhism is generally just worshipping. Go and worship, and then do rituals, and nothing more. The other way, on the other hand, a lot of modern people think that Buddhism is about meditation, nothing else. You go there, go to retreat here, retreat there, and do nothing else. It's not that either. The Buddha did not simply go and meditate alone, just only do meditation. You look at his lifetime, he goes around helping people. If he doesn't go helping people and leave behind his teachings, we won't be benefiting from the teachings now. Right? So that is the thing. We got to be engaged with other people. Engage with them not to party, not to drink, not to eat, but to discuss Dharma and talk Dharma. Right? Just simply sitting down, go to retreat and meditate and think there are other people all stupid is not a good thing either. Okay? So the other thing is, a lot of times you find that there are a lot of superstitions being promoted, especially among this group. When you have faith, then they start telling you the Buddha can fly. Then you, if you bow so many times, you get so many merits. If you bow 2,000 times, you get 2,000 merits. Then you can see some of the Tibetan pilgrims, they go on and do full body prostration. I mean, if they do it for training of concentration, it's okay. But they do it, they think that, this is a lot of merit. Then there's something they've got to improve on. And some people believe that to be a Buddhist is to withdraw from the world. I've got a monk who I got a long argument with. He says, renouncing the world. I said, but you're living in this world, how can you renounce the world? You renounce the world means you don't eat our food, you don't wear our clothes, you see. So it's not renouncing the world, it's renouncing your temptation, renouncing your attachment. And some of the misconceptions of Buddhism, especially in modern day world, is Buddhism encourages people to become monks and nuns. In my community, there are a lot of people who think that way. So they are so scared that if they let the children learn Buddhism, they are going to be monks and nuns, they are not going to be grandparents. So what they do is they send the children to church. There are so funny people around. And of course, the last one I want to bring is quite a very popular misconception is we are not socially engaged. You find that a lot of Buddhists do not want to go and do the service to other people. And that has got to change too. Because the Buddha has done a lot of social service to other people. He lives simply, but
we can get and so engage with other people, talk about the problems, try to solve the problems. Okay, that's the end of my talk. And any question?
Did I make myself, like, are you clear about that?
Can you know what does Chinese think about vegetarianism?
Well, we got to look at it. Now, there are a lot of reasons for people to be vegetarian. This is the same thing as there are a lot of people who want to worship that image or want to burn this candle or that candle. So there are reasons for that. It's their own personal reasons. So while when you have something and when you start to put arguments on it, then you use a lot of reasoning on it. So the Buddha himself did not really encourage vegetarianism, and neither does he forbid that. In fact, if you look at the history of the story of Buddha, one of his cousins who tried to rebel against him wanted the Buddha to impose the law of vegetarianism on his followers, but the Buddha says no, one of the laws. So you can see it's that. But if a person has got a will to want to be vegetarian and he believes that by doing being a vegetarian that don't cause animals to be slaughtered, then it's a good thing. But it shouldn't be enforced. There's nowhere
in the scripture where the Buddha says you must be vegetarian. Okay?
I believe that, for me myself, I'm vegetarian for 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's because it's for the compassion of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want animal to kill because of me. And because I was brought up in the northern tradition, mm-hmm. So I'm used to see
monks and vegetarian.
So I know that there are a lot of caravans that monks are vegetarian as well.
Mm-hmm.
But to some, there are some monasteries that I visit, mm-hmm. some Thai monasteries, where I see that all the food they are meat, and I feel uncomfortable. This is just my personal experience. I feel uncomfortable because I understand that during the Buddha time, the Buddha didn't encourage vegetarian because he didn't accept whatever people give him.
Mm-hmm.
He would just eat whatever people give him. He wanted to create trouble for the others. But I think a lot of monasteries, even they don't have a kitchen or they don't cook for themselves, but I think their disciples and their followers cook it specially for them.
Mm.
So is it possible? I think that there's a possibility that this lady knows that this monk likes to eat chicken, so she cook chicken for him.
Yeah. So the thing is, the whole thing is we know that these people are there. That sort of thinking is in most things, right? So only time when we zoom into all these things, we can see that there's a lot of flaws in this sort of thinking, right?
But however, we got to look into the other thing as well, on what we call attachment, right? If a person is too attached to meat, then there's attachment. When you're attachment to vegetarianism, there's also attachment, right? So even my teacher, I'm from a northern tradition as well, right? My monk or my master is a vegetarian, right? But if somebody were to offer him meat, he won't eat the meat. But he doesn't mind. If he's got nothing else to eat, he'll eat the meat. Right? So that's the way we look at things. Right? So if we look at it and we accept a more tolerance. Now, you were telling me that you feel uncomfortable. That's because we are attached to one kind of ideology, right? And therefore we are uncomfortable. Right? Recently, somebody visited me from Taiwan, and I know that she's a very strict vegetarian, right? Very strict, but she didn't tell anybody. So we go out and eat, and the whole group there, and nobody bothered about her vegetarianism. Then I didn't notice that. I didn't notice that she's a vegetarian at all. But she ate like we do. Then after that, somebody told me, so and so is a vegetarian. So I said, but she goes with us to eat in the restaurant. And says, next time he goes, you see how she eats. Then what she do is they put the fish there. She doesn't eat the fish. She eats the thing, the vegetarian around there. You know? So I call it the the vegetables amongst the meat. Right? So that I think that's a very good attitude if you do that. So it's alright. If they eat meat, it's alright. If they eat vegetables, it's alright. So try not to be too attached to food. Like, because when you get attached to food, that can be also a problem. Now, again, this is a joke. I mean, I consider it a joke, but it's a real story. Eh? I read it in the Sydney Morning Herald about 20 years ago, reporting on a nun in Taiwan. One day she ate a bottle of, a can of baked beans. It's made in Taiwan. And then she opened the baked beans, she ate it, because she thinks it's vegetarian. Right? And the Chinese vegetarian, it's not only you can't eat meat, but also the garlic and So she thought it's no, all right. So she opened the thing, after eating, she read that something went wrong, she read the jar, she saw condensed garlic. And after that, it's vegetarian, but this vegetarian is vegetarian, but to them, that's the thing. And then to her, now, again, this belief, right? It's talking about this the icing. She believed that eating garlic makes her break her precepts of vegetarianism or of not eating meat. So, I mean, to her, that's in her mind. See? So she gets so worried about it. She said, I broke my precept now. If you really follow the teaching of Buddha, I broke my precept, that's it, finished. Right? Make a confession and then you live your life again. That's how the Buddha taught people to do. So, but she got so worried about it and said, oh, I broke my precept, and she started to get worried. Right? And when you're very worried, you get depressed. And finally, she died. And when she died, she tell people, I died because I ate that stupid can of beans. Now, you see how the attachment goes? Right? And then, not only that, after she died, her chief disciple wanted to sue the company. To see how attachment goes wrong. Right? So, we have got attachment like that in different levels. Right? And when you see the others, there are some who, okay, I can eat with you. But I'm not eating the meat. Some of you know, I'm not going to eat at all. And I got a vegetarian friend who always, whenever I've invited people for dinner, says, don't forget that I'm a vegetarian. In the case you are not invited.
Yeah. I'm more easygoing vegetarian. So I do have meals with friends who are not vegetarians. But from my experience, I feel that way. Because like some people, you ask them to be a vegetarian, they say no, it's impossible for them. It's because they love the meat, it's tasty. Right? So, one thing I found is since I've become a vegetarian, I'm easier with food. I become contented easily with food.
I think it can work in many ways. There are some people who are attached to one or the other. Right? If you look at the extremes, then there are a lot of problems. But you look somewhere in the middle. The moderate meat eater and the moderate vegetarian, they are all the same. Right? So, a lot of people, in fact, in my circle, that's when you go to vegetarian people's home, I don't go and pound the table and say, I want meat. Whatever you put there, I'll eat. So, same thing with the moderate vegetarians. Right? They come to my place, they look at me, okay, you know, this is salad, this is the bread, and they eat the salad and the bread. No complaints. But you got the extreme ones. Right? On this hand, you go to a vegetarian place, you guys don't know how to eat, and all this thing. On the other hand, these vegetarians, they go to the meat eater's place, you know your stomach? They are graveyards for animals. And then, worse still is nowadays, there are people who promote superstitious thoughts. Right? They tell you, you eat that meat, right? You eat meat, you'll be turned into a peta when you die. Right? That means the hungry ghost. And then, worse still is there's one book written, I read it, it's written in Chinese. The Chinese have 18 hells. The Chinese Buddhists, they have 18 hells. They say if you don't become a vegetarian, you will end up in the 19th hell. You see, all the 18 hells are all temporary. And then they invented the 19th hell for permanent, because they learned from the Christians, the permanent hell. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. Now when you go, so try not to go into that way. Now, let's talk about what? Not too extreme, right in the middle. So it doesn't mean that if you like to be a vegetarian, be a vegetarian. If you like to be a meat eater, be a meat eater. But do not drop into those two ends. The Chinese say don't fall into the two sides.
Okay. So any other comments, questions?